Hello, I'm Jeff Fiddler. This is number 0521, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0521. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, legendary journalist Ivor Davis, author of Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. He was in the courtroom for Charles Manson's trial. He says the conviction was right, but based on the wrong evidence.
Covering the trial, I think listening and watching Manson behave in court for nearly a year, the jury would have convicted of him of anything because the guy was lunacy in action. You know what it boils down to? I think the ends justified the means, and Bugliosi got a conviction of a man who was guilty of these murders, who did send his people out to kill senselessly. So, you know, who's complaining?
Mike St. Lawrence is the man to go to if you're looking to buy alien abduction insurance. How did he start selling alien abduction insurance?
I checked my homeowner's policy and I found out that I wasn't covered for a risk like that. Along with a few friends and the innovator of the Japanese junk bond, we formed the UFO Abduction Insurance Company. Reluctantly changed the name to Alien Abduction Insurance because that's what the public wanted.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0521, was Jeff Fiddler, a former broadcaster and someone I used to work with many years ago, who is now the president of Audience Insights Incorporated, a media research consulting company. You can find their website at audience-insights.com. That's audience-insights.com. You could also find their website by going to thestufffile.com. Check the show number for this program, which you just heard Jeff mention. See how it all comes back full circle? And you'll find the link to Jeff's site. Thank you very much, Jeff, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And by the way, the Stuff File program is also now heard on Spotify. So for those of you who have a Spotify account, please subscribe to the Stuff File program on your Spotify account. Thank you very much. Now, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, will someone please tell me why this item is a thing? A group of scientists announced that they have created vodka from ingredients harvested from inside the Chernobyl exclusion zone and verified that it is safe to drink. Atomic vodka, and atomic is spelt with a K, by the way, was created by University of Portsmouth scientists from grain and water from inside the exclusion zone as part of a 3-year research project into the radioactivity of crops grown inside the 19-mile radius around the Chernobyl nuclear plant, which experienced a reactor explosion back in 1986. Said one project member, actually the project leader, Jim Smith, 30 years on after the accident, we found that in the area the crops was slightly above the very cautious Ukrainian limit for consumption. So, technically, you can't eat those crops. But we thought, well, we've got some grain, why don't we try making a vodka? Smith's team found distilling the vodka reduced the radioactivity contamination to an undetectable level, making it safe to drink. He said the newly founded Chernobyl Spirit Company will soon be selling atomic vodka, with 75% of profits going to communities affected by the disaster. The vodka will be the first consumer product from the inclusion zone since the disaster. Okay. A few things disturb me about this story. First of all, By the time they distill it, scientists say it's safe. But how safe are the people who actually go and get the grain in the first place? Second, despite all the assurances being offered by the scientists, would you really take their word for it and line up to buy and taste this stuff? And third, this will be the first consumer product from the exclusion zone. Does this mean they're planning more? What's next? Chickens that are a hot commodity because they come with extra wings and drumsticks? Yikes! You know, scientists are spending their time doing this. Meanwhile, we still don't have a cure for cancer. Just saying. Okay, a Louisiana woman who fired several shots at a small airplane spraying for mosquitoes claimed that she thought that the manned aircraft passing over her home was a drone. Cops allege that 40-year-old Stacy Nien Rogers fired at the plane three times in an attempt to bring down the aircraft as it flew passes over her home in Monroe early in the morning. When investigators questioned Rogers, she confessed to shooting at the drone with a revolver-style pistol that was confiscated by police. Officers noted that Rogers was intoxicated when booked into the local jail. None of Rogers' rounds hit their intended airborne target. Police determined that the plane Rogers shot at was spraying for mosquitoes in an area where multiple mosquito pools have recently tested positive for the West Nile virus. Okay, first of all, please take note that this plane was flying early in the morning. Also, at the same time, Stacy is intoxicated. Just how early does Stacy start drinking? I mean, the early bird gets the worm, but is that worm at the bottom of a tequila bottle? Also, notice how many stories over the years we've had involving intoxicated people and guns. It's ironic that the government agency that deals with these items is called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. I've always said, this doesn't sound like a winning combination. Yeah. A road incident on a state highway in Dodge City, Alabama, apparently resulted in a couple's rage. Erica Cole was in the passenger seat as her husband Nicholas was driving. She pulled out a gun to shoot through the window at the other car, according to sheriff's investigators, while the victim's vehicle was on the left side of their car. Something got in the way of the bullet. Nicholas's head. Amazingly, he survived and was hospitalized in stable condition. Erica has been charged with attempted murder, assault, and reckless endangerment. Wow, Nicholas may live in Dodge City, but he certainly couldn't dodge a bullet. Now, you'd think that a story like that would be an oddity, a one-off, something that couldn't possibly happen more than once. Oh, but wait, there's more. 26-year-old Matthew Gibson and 27-year-old Jake Lee of Chicago allegedly planned a drive-by shooting. As Gibson drove, Lee spotted the target and opened fire with a .40-caliber pistol. A 22-year-old man was wounded, but Lee was shooting through Gibson's window and at least one round hit him in the head. Gibson was able to drive more than 2 miles before collapsing. Lee is being held without bail on a murder charge, and Gibson was kept on life support long enough to harvest his organs for transplants. I'm guessing the 22-year-old that they wounded is only feeling pain because he can't stop laughing. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a 9mm Glock was taken from a bedroom during a sex party in which guests wore masks during the orgy and were encouraged to use code names. The handgun was swiped from a Deltona, Florida home during a weekend sex party, and the gun owner couldn't give detectives any names of possible suspects because the culprit, like the 20 or so other guests at the party, was wearing a mask. Said Volusia County Sheriff Sergeant Todd Smith, "We're probably not going to solve this one. and DNA identification is not going to be an option. Oh, thank the Lord for that, because who wants that job? I mean, turning on a black light in that room would probably make it look like a Jackson Pollock painting. According to the homeowner, the 9mm Glock was holstered and lying on top of a nightstand in the master bedroom when it was stolen. It was taken during an orgy in which the theme was anonymous sex. Guests who were invited to the party were encouraged to come and go as they pleased. Well, that's an unfortunate turn of phrase. Throughout the weekend, and were told to bring friends and acquaintances if they so desired. Additionally, guests were told to use fictitious names or no names at all. The orgy took place July 19th to 21st, and deputies were contacted a few days later. If they were all wearing masks, wouldn't there be other physical characteristics by which to identify them by? Yeah, wouldn't that make an interesting police lineup? Okay, let's overlook the inviting strangers to your home for an orgy aspect of this story. What I would like to know is, generally speaking, who gives free rein of their house for the weekend to over 20 strangers? Yikes! Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? August 9th was the 50th anniversary of the Tate-LaBianca murders, what came to be known as the Manson family murders. On that day, back in 1969, Ivor Davis, an investigative journalist for the London Daily Express, was at the Tate-LaBianca murder scene before noon, surrounded by the Los Angeles and foreign press. He followed the case intently and interviewed Manson family members and ex-members, gathering an intricate picture of the cult and its charismatic leader, Charles Manson. Before the trial began in the summer of 1970, Ivor co-authored the first book published about the murders called Five to Die. And 50 years later, he has the latest book. It's called Manson Exposed, a reporter's 50-year journey into madness and murder. Ivor joins us on the line via Skype from Southern California. Hi, Ivor.
Hello, Peter. I'm very well, thank you. And thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. We had you back on the program about 3 years ago when your book, The Beatles and Me on Tour, came out. And clearly, you don't hang around with just anybody.
Well, you know, that's a nice way of putting it. But, you know, the interesting thing, Peter, is that I became very close to the Beatles on that tour. And then I cover this murder, this horrible murder, several years later, like 5 years later. And the Beatles are sort of involved, much to their chagrin, in this awful murder.
Now, there was, yeah, I've often heard this story. Some people say it's true, some people say it's not. You were there with both groups. So tell us the truth. What is the connection, if any, with the Beatles?
Well, here's the nitty-gritty. Basically, the district attorney, Vincent Bugliosi, went to, much to my utter astonishment, with the motive that the murders were as a result of Charlie Manson listening to the Beatles' White Album and songs like Helter Skelter, Piggies, Revolution, and he brainwashed his followers to believe that those songs were secret messages to Manson warning him that a race riot in America was imminent. And as a result, Manson sent out his minions to kill, to sort of ignite the race riot. Now, I want to tell you, when I heard that story from members of the Manson clan before the trial began, I thought it was utter rubbish. And then a year later, when I sat in court and heard the story spilled from the lips of the district attorney, I still felt it was utter rubbish. And 50 years later, I cannot believe that the district attorney got a conviction based on the kind of Beatles lyrics made me do it. The world is a crazy place, Peter.
So what you're saying is it's right that he got them convicted, but he convicted them. But he convicted them on the wrong set of evidence?
Well, basically, I think he realized that if he went on the motive that the reason that Manson sent out the killers on two nights was to cover up and get one of his buddies out of prison, the jury would have thought that was a stretch. And somehow he spun them this marvelous story about Helter Skelter and the Beatles lyrics, and he got the jury to convict. Now, I must tell you that covering the trial, I think listening and watching Manson behave in court for nearly a year, the jury would have convicted of him of anything, because the guy was a lunacy in action. And so, look, you know what it boils down to? I think the ends justified the means, and Bugliosi got a conviction of a man who was guilty of these murders, who did send his people out to kill senselessly. So, you know, who's complaining?
Now, as I mentioned, you wrote the first book, Five to Die. You've now written this book 50 years later, Manson Exposed. You were at the crime scene before noon the day of the murder. You followed this through the court case. How much of this case, this trial, this saga affected you? How did it affect you through the years? Because it was a harrowing situation, even though you weren't there at the murders, but through the whole aftermath and everything else, how did it play on your mind?
Well, I mean, I was always very, I wouldn't say scared, but apprehensive is better. And the reason I was apprehensive was that on the first day of the trial, Lynn Squeaky Frome, who was a Manson acolyte, a devoted Manson faithful follower, who was not involved in the murders, greeted me on the first day of the trial, and she knew that I was anti-Manson and anti the family. And she turned to me and said, "Iva, do you know what it feels like to have a knife, a sharp knife stuck down your throat?" Well, to be honest with you, that's not normal everyday conversation. And I felt a little bit scared then. I raced to the phone. I got my wife and my baby daughter to move out of my house. And they did for about a month. So from day one, it was scary. But, you know, when you're a journalist, you're supposed to not get involved emotionally. You're supposed to be an objective reporter. And so I guess I basically threw away my fears and covered the story. But when I look back, I realized that not only was I in danger, but so was the district attorney and so was the judge. Because, Peter, one thing that people do not know is that Manson and the girls were in prison, but there were many other Manson devotees running around wildly who would have done whatever Manson told them to do, and even if it meant try to kill people.
What made you decide at this time for the 50th anniversary to bring out this book? Why not bring out a book at the 25th year, the 30th year? Why now?
2 years ago, I was with my daughter in Seattle, and two young men were remodeling the kitchen, and we started talking about crime and murder. And I said, "You know, what do you know about Charles Manson?" And one of the guys said, "Oh, yeah, he was the guy that wanted a clean environment. He wanted clean air. And the cops railroaded him on a murder charge that he never committed." And I thought, my God, if you've got young people believing that Manson was totally innocent, I've got to do something to prove that he was innocent, that he was guilty. Sorry, he was guilty. So I pulled it all together, my memories, my interviews. I did a lot. I did about 100 new interviews. And in piecing it together, you kind of get the big picture, because I haven't sat down and thought about this for quite a long time.
Well, as a journalist, and you know, from a more global perspective, the impetus, you said, for writing this book was talking to these two guys and their somewhat twisted thoughts about what Charles Manson was. That being said, how as a journalist do you feel today about what is happening to the business that you have spent your life in, where people don't believe what true journalists are doing?
Well, it's scary that happens. You know, I'm going to change the subject slightly. I don't know if many of those listening in have seen the Quentin Tarantino movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But all I will say is that they go and see it and they do not know the true circumstances of what happened, they will come out of the movie quite happy. I mean, it's, I don't want to spoil the film for people, but Quentin Tarantino has done a big $90 million movie with a Grimm's fairy tale happy ending. I mean, it's crazy. So many people won't know the truth, but hopefully if they take the time to go out and buy my book or read my book, then they would discover the horrible truth of Charles Manson and not what Mr. Tarantino has put in his movie.
But again, that goes back to my earlier question, because, you know, to give respect to Tarantino, both films like this and both films like one of his previous ones, Inglourious Basterds.
Exactly.
Neither one of them were documentaries, nor did he ever say they were documentaries. And he often talked about...
You're absolutely right. This is not a documentary, and Inglourious Basterds, where Mr. Tarantino ended up killing Hitler, was not a documentary. But pop culture has a strange way of affecting people. And people go in, there's not a disclaimer saying this is all a fairy story for the Tarantino film. But there are some people that will see it and believe what he has put on the screen as being the truth. And listen, I was totally engrossed by Tarantino's film. I mean, I would recommend it to anyone because it captures absolutely spectacularly 1969, the mood, the music, the atmosphere, and the horrible Spahn movie ranch where Manson and his followers lived. So I don't know if that kind of half answers your question, but, you know, even today there are people out there, believe me, and I see them on the websites, that believe that Manson was innocent. So, you know, I don't know what to say about that. I'm baffled.
We're talking with Ivor Davis, who is the author of Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. We're going to take a short break and continue talking with Ivor on the other side. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Stick around.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And The Stuff File program is heard everywhere, including Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're talking with Ivor Davis, who is the author of Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. Ivor, in putting this book together, did you have an opportunity to talk to any of the still surviving members of the Manson family?
The answer to that was no. But what I did do is I spoke to many lawyers that were involved. I spoke to people that knew the lawyers. I spoke to Roman Polanski, and I then started, and I had also interviewed Terry Melcher. And Terry Melcher, if most of your listeners may recall, was a hotshot record producer, obviously the son of the great legendary star Doris Day. And Melcher got himself sucked into the Manson pit, cesspit, because he went along to audition Manson with a view to giving him a recording contract. So I spoke to all these people. A lot of the stuff that in my new book I didn't have when I wrote my first book, obviously. And time and distance and years gives you a clearer perspective. And that's, I mean, there is so much more. When I covered the Beatles in 1964 and wrote a book, it covered 5 weeks. Manson Exposed covers 50 years, so it's a bigger bite.
You spoke to Roman Polanski. Obviously, his wife, Sharon Tate, was the murder victim in this original horrific case. Was it difficult for him to talk about the murders, even though it was so many years after?
It was very difficult for him to talk about the murders, but the reason, it was painful then, at the beginning, because I remember seeing him a week, 3 days after the murders, and then I saw him in Paris. Part of the reason he was willing to talk to me about everything was because he was desperate to come back to Hollywood and make movies. He would like still to come back. But of course, as most people may recall, he blotted his copybook very badly by being admitting sex with an underage young woman. They were going to send him back to jail, and he decided to run away, and he left America and is now a fugitive from American justice. So he thought, by talking to me, that I would write a sympathetic story, which I did, about him, and that it would help pave the way for Hollywood bringing him back. But as of today, Mr. Polanski is in Paris and still a fugitive from American justice.
Well, since you said he was hoping you'd write a sympathetic story, were you ever concerned at all with what he was giving you was a rose-colored version of what happened because he wanted a sympathetic story from you?
Well, partly, yes. I mean, when I questioned him about his sexual proclivities with an underage girl, he kind of tried to explain it, which I thought was rather rubbish. I mean, he did what he did, and he should have said he did what he did. But then he said, you know, then when we talked about the murders and the after effect, he was very emotional. It was still hard for Roman, not surprisingly, to talk about the fact that he went back. He left Hollywood, and his wife was pregnant, expecting their first son, their first baby. And when he returned, she and the baby were dead. I mean, you know, it was tough. And as most people may know, Polanski's childhood was a troubled childhood. I mean, he lost his mother in the Holocaust. And Polanski is a tragic figure in true life. So, you know, he was fairly honest with me about everything. And the interview was actually excellent.
Charles Manson is probably the most notorious murderer, not serial killer, but mass murderer that we know of. There are a lot of books written about him. You've now written two. Has there ever been a concern on your part about glorifying this really heinous murderer?
Well, my actual book does not glorify Manson. It tells the truth. But, and this is a big but, you've got to remember there was a 20-year period. Look, if Manson had been executed, and he was sent to the gas chamber. If Manson had been executed, you and I would not be having this conversation. But, you know, getting back to the genesis of your question, Charlie Manson was an actor, a poseur, and he worked the system to his benefit. I mean, for a 20-year period, Diane Sawyer and a multitude of big names on television were lining up to interview the monster in jail, and they did it. And our worst nightmare came true. Charles Manson invaded our living rooms thanks to these primetime interviews. And thanks to these primetime interviews, people were entertained because they were safe, and they saw this kind of guy strutting around, and he was value for money. If you look at any of the interviews he did over that period of 15 to 20 years, he became famous, he entertained, and he gave us what we wanted, the monster up close.
I remember seeing the Tom Snyder interview many years ago when I was a kid, when that first came out. To what you're saying, the fact that he was in jail all this time and had some of the necessities of life, I mean, one of the last things I remember, they confiscated a cell phone from him that he had smuggled into the prison. And in my thinking, considering how far back he went into prison in the first place, he shouldn't even know what a cell phone is.
Well, you know, a lot of stuff was smuggled to Manson. He had a cell phone, and I'm not exactly sure who he called, but, you know, all I was told by one of his prison guards, who I interviewed for this book, was that you can do amazing things hiding amazing things in various body orifices. I think you get the picture.
Yes.
So Manson used the phone until they discovered it, and he manipulated as much as he could in jail. He tried to stay out of trouble. Somebody did try and kill him, and set him on fire. So even in jail, Manson managed. And people, prison guards told me that Manson was the celebrity in jail. And whenever a prison official came to visit the jail, believe it or not, he said, "I'd like to meet Manson." I mean, come on. It's crazy, isn't it?
Do you think he enjoyed his notoriety?
Yes. Oh, yes. Because don't forget, Charlie Manson started out after coming out of jail desperately wanting to be a rock star, a composer. And he was a singer, and he did compose music, but he never made it as a rock star. But he made it as somebody who was even a bigger star than Jack the Ripper. So Manson's notoriety is huge. I mean, when I wrote this book, several people said to me, we don't want to give you any kind of writer's insurance because you've got Manson in the title. But I said, the guy's dead. I mean, so that's the kind of power and horrendous attraction that Manson brings to the party.
Well, that's an interesting point. You talked about at the time when you first started covering Charles Manson, that what you mentioned about Squeaky Fromm, the fact that you got your family out of the house while this was all going on. And what you just said about people who, when you were writing this book, are there still people to fear when you talk against Charles Manson? Are there still people out there that we should fear?
Well, you know, I hope not. But the true answer to your question is yes, because if I didn't go to his funeral because they wouldn't have welcomed me, but I did see tremendously detailed footage of the funeral, which of course was filmed by one of his grandsons. I saw the footage and I saw a bunch of rather crazy people paying homage to Mr. Manson. I mean, like he was a great man. So there are people out there, and there are even the girls that were around 50 years ago who still believe in Charlie. They're around, they're much older. I would hope they're not much threat, but they're around, and there are other people who believe Manson got a raw deal. So, you know, I suppose I should be a little more cautious about what I say and do, but I'm getting on a bit now, and who knows?
So, to clarify what you just said, there are people out there who, like the guys who were working on your house, think that he got a raw deal in that he was innocent. Are there those who revere him because they thought he was right, and he was guilty but right?
No, I think those who revere him still say, well, Charlie didn't kill anyone. Mm. Charlie didn't kill anybody at the Sharon Tate house. Charlie didn't kill them at the La Bianca house. So he's right. He didn't kill them. However, what a lot of people don't know is that on the second night of the murders in August 1969, Charlie drove with them to the La Bianca house. He went into the La Bianca house. He tied up the La Biancas. He left the house and he told his acolytes to go in and kill them. And he went home. And, it's a bit like the bank robbers who were driven to the bank by the getaway driver. Is the getaway driver as guilty? Manson took them to the house. Is he as guilty as them, even though he didn't stab anyone? Legally, I think he is culpable.
And he certainly is the ringleader.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever that he conspired and sent them out to do the murders.
It's a fascinating topic. Again, most of the stuff you write about are fascinating topics. And that's partially because you yourself, through journalism, you've led a fascinating life.
Well, you know, journalism has been, rather cornily, my ticket to ride. because, you know, it's taken me to the Beatles. It's taken me into the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel the night Bobby Kennedy was shot. And it's taken me to a front row seat from day one of this awful, awful, notorious series of murders. And along the way, as a journalist, you know, you get to be an eyewitness to history. But if you can stop long enough to realize that you're an eyewitness to history.
Ivor, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. The book is Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Ivor Davis, author of Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0521, and you'll find links to Ivor's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about alien abduction insurance. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and now also on Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free, please, oh please, to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? When a homeowner in Land O'Lakes, Florida, went into his garage, he noticed a case of beer on the couch there. Then he noticed a man sleeping on a bench. I don't know what time he got here, but he's real sorry he came to my house, said the homeowner, identified only as Ron. He confronted the man, who ran, but not before grabbing a pair of Ron's son's boxer shorts from a laundry pile, which became the only clothes the man was wearing as he ran. Police located 33-year-old Jonathan Whitney in some bushes, still wearing only dirty boxers. He surrendered to deputies and was charged with burglary of an occupied dwelling, indecent exposure, and resisting an officer without violence. "Drinking my bush beer, you've crossed the line," Ron said. Wait, that's the line that he crossed? Not the fact that he broke into the garage? Also, did he arrive in the garage naked? And if so, where the heck are his clothes? And still on the au naturel theme, Virginia State Police say a Greyhound bus passenger got naked, demanded to be let off a moving bus, and ran into oncoming highway traffic where he was hit and killed. Police Public Relations Director Corrine Ann Geller said in a news release that the extremely agitated man began taking off his clothes on a Greyhound bus on Thursday night. He then struck the front windshield, causing it to crack, while demanding to be let off the bus. The release says the bus driver pulled over and the man exited. He ran into oncoming traffic and was fatally hit by another vehicle. The man died at the scene. The other driver wasn't injured. Virginia State Police is investigating the crash. You know, I'm guessing the remaining passengers on the bus were upset because this was going to put a crimp in their destination arrival time. I mean, if it isn't the traffic, it's naked roadkill. A Florida man was arrested after pointing a gun at two delivery men when they arrived late with his furniture, threatening that he has, quote, shot people for less, unquote. The suspect, 55-year-old Mitchell Helton of Manatee County, immediately began complaining when the delivery men showed up late with the furniture he ordered on August the 3rd. The men asked if he still wanted the furniture, and Helton allegedly told them to, quote, do whatever you want, unquote. He then allegedly grabbed his gun and pointed it at both of the men as he walked out of his house. You know I've shot people for less, he allegedly said. The delivery man called for police after the threat, and Helton was arrested soon after. He was charged with two counts of aggravated assault. So, wait a minute. Did they leave the furniture? Also, I'm assuming Helton isn't a gracious tipper either. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Florida couple's toilet exploded when lightning struck their septic tank. The reason? Methane gas. Said Jordan Hagedon, the owner of the business repairing the couple's toilet, methane gas is gas caused by the number two. The natural gas is from crap, literally. Well, thanks for that, Captain Obvious. Over time, as people use their bathroom, methane gas builds up in the septic tank as it's filled. The lightning was the perfect source for ignition. It was very scary, said homeowner Mary Lou Ward. The explosion was very loud. The couple was still in bed that morning when they heard the toilet and pipes blow up. Said their plumber on his Facebook post, the toilet exploded in the master bathroom, sending porcelain airborne like a missile. The porcelain of the toilet actually penetrated the wall. Wow. I know what you're all thinking out there. Could you imagine if someone was using the toilet at the time? Is that the way you really want to be found? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? You can get an insurance policy for just about any tragedy that may come your way. But what if you're abducted by aliens? Well, you can get that coverage too. Since 1987, Mike St. Lawrence, owner of the St. Lawrence Agency in Altamont Springs, Florida, has been filling that missing gap in the insurance industry. His policies provide $10 million of coverage in case of alien abduction. Mike joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Mike.
How you doing?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Okay, well, I appreciate your interest.
You started this in 1987. When did you realize that there was a gap in the insurance industry that wasn't being fulfilled?
Well, actually, I'd seen a TV interview on CNN with Larry King and an author that wrote a best-selling book called Communion, and I can't think of his name right now. Whitley Strieber is his name, if that rings any bells to you. But he was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and he came out with a book called Communion. And it's the one with the alien face on the cover, and it kind of was a bestseller, and it kind of popularized the whole notion of UFO abductions in America. I mean, in this country.
Okay.
So I checked my homeowner's policy, and I found out that I wasn't covered for a risk like that. And along with few friends and the innovator of the Japanese junk bond, we formed the back then it was the UFO Abduction Insurance Company, and I reluctantly changed the name to Alien Abduction Insurance because that's what the public wanted.
Okay, so what exactly does one get? First of all, what does it cost to get this policy, and what does one get for this policy?
Okay, well, it's a single lifetime premium of either $19.95 for a digital copy that we send to you the same day you order it, or for $24.95, we send you a paper copy with the frequent flyer endorsement and the claim form and one of my business cards and a nice little folder. And they're suitable for framing. Most people usually buy this gift
for someone else and then name themselves the beneficiary.
Wow.
So I should... So does anybody know it's a $10 million policy? Have we mentioned that yet?
Yeah, okay. Yes, I did mention it's a $10 million coverage.
Okay, and $20 million double indemnity.
And $20 million double indemnity. Now, in all the years you've been doing this, as I said, since 1987, have you paid out any claims?
Yes, we have. We have two claims that we approved up in your neck of the woods, really, in New York State. I think you're in Montreal. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Okay. Well, we had in different ends of the state, we had one individual that submitted a claim. And usually on our claim form, you have to get a signature of an authorized onboard alien on the form itself. Okay? It can't be somebody making scrambled eggs in the galley or anything like that. It's got to be somebody with the authority. And we recently added Area 51 coverage for all the people that are going out to try to storm the Area 51. And you got to make sure you bring your claim form with you and get the signature.
So you need a signature of an alien. Okay,
right.
So you say you've paid out a couple of claims. So obviously this person had the signature of an alien. Anything else is required?
No. I should correct that. He did not have a signature, but he had what I would consider tangible evidence to support his claim. He said he had an implant, and that implant was examined by an MIT professor, and he said that it was not made of any earthly substance. He couldn't verify that it came out of his body because he didn't see it until it was after already out of his body. But since he had that, we waived the signature, he was the very first person to collect the $10 million. And I should go over our terms and conditions a little bit.
I was about to ask, exactly how is that $10 million paid out?
Well, we're a lot like the lottery or the publisher's clearinghouse in that we pay in installments of $1 a year for 10 million years.
Gotcha. Okay.
So... you don't have a sense of humor, you don't want to buy this.
Well, are there, now that you bring that up, are there some restrictions as to people who cannot or who would not be allowed to purchase this abduction insurance?
You can't be turned down regardless of your age or your frequent flyer status.
Okay.
Okay, so it's pretty open to everybody. It's reasonably priced. We do everything we say we're going to do. In fact, I'm getting a lot of people about the Area 51, but there's a lot of interest in wanting to know people that have sent in claims. And I'm trying to encourage people to make a claim, okay, if you want to. A lot of people, when I started it, thought this was completely absurd, and I was just making fun of the absurdity and people being abducted. But they know more people have come around to thinking that it's a possibility now. And a lot of people that have had the experience have purchased the policy knowing that it's a tongue-in-cheek policy because it shows that they have a sense of humor about the situation that they're in. So it's got some benefits there. But more and more people are... I'm trying to get as many claims submitted as I can get,
now,
to be honest with you.
I understand you've sold nearly 6,000 of these, and one of the reasons, and you've been doing this, as I said, since 1989, one of the reasons we called you is because you're in the news because of those folks who plan to storm Area 51 in September. Apparently, as many as 2 million people have said they're going to Roswell, New Mexico. Whether that turns out to be true or not, I don't know. This is something that was started by a guy named Matty Roberts. So since this has been in the news, have you been garnering more attention now than you have over the last little while?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's been a catalyst. Starting in the end of March, beginning of April, there's a TV program that came on the History Channel called Unidentified. It's about the Tic Tac
Navy things. Have you heard of that at all?
Yep.
And it really started a buzz. And it's been, since the series was on, I think they ended the first season of it about 3 weeks ago.
Are you talking about the series where some pilots believe that they have seen UFOs?
Well, they've got video.
Yes.
And you can look through the cockpit, and it's pretty amazing. They've got this tic-tac object that's about the big as a bus. It's going like Mach 2 or something like that, speed of sound. And it turns around and goes backward and still goes straight. So it's something going on that there's a technology going on that we don't understand, but it's, you know, I can't say, but it's made a lot of people more interested in the subject matter.
Now, how many people have you heard from who are planning on going to Area 51 in September, including Maddie Roberts? Have you heard from any of them mm-hmm. who want to get policies for themselves? Or have you heard from their loved ones who are getting policies on their behalf?
Well, I'd say both is true. We've had a big spike in sales since that was in the news. And I went to the, in 99, I went to the 50th anniversary of the Roswell crash in New Mexico. I don't know if you remember that or not, but that was it was heavily publicized in the national media. And they expected 100,000 people to be there. And I went as a vendor. I was selling, at the time, UFO abduction insurance out of a tent that looked like an aircraft hangar. And we did real well out there. And we have another product. It gets a little bit too much info for me to go into that now. But I told one of the reporters after it was over, they asked me how we did, and you know, it was a success, and it was. We were like the second most popular product that people were selling out there, and they treated us royally. I thought I might have people that were abductees or people that researched, you know, not like it or anything, but nobody complained. Everybody seemed to like it.
So are you planning on going there in September? Because, I mean, I don't know. I doubt 2 million people are going to show up, but I'm assuming there'll be a decent number of people who will show up. You could probably sell quite a few policies to the entrance of going to Roswell.
Yeah. I think I did that Roswell thing when I was 50 years old, and I stood out there in that 117-degree heat. And I don't think I'm going to be making it to Area 51. I'm too old now. But there's something going on with I'm 71 now. I've got TV stations in Las Vegas, but we're working on some stuff. There's a lot of excitement about it. The biggest thing is this many people are interested in the subject. Mm. That when 2 million people sign up, there's not going to be 2 million people. There's no place for 2 million people.
Exactly.
You know, out there. There's one little town where the little alien inn is, and that's only 53 people in the whole thing. And they only have one road coming in, and there's one gas station there. It could be a, you know, nightmare. But it could turn into Woodstock, too.
If anybody out there listening right now wants to get their own alien abduction insurance, either for themselves or their loved ones, they can go to your website, which is UFO2001.com, correct?
That is correct.
And it's $19.95 if they want a policy, or if they want to spend an extra $5, that's $24.95. They can have a certificate suitable for framing that will be sent to them. The $19.95 one is merely digital.
Correct. But they're both suitable for framing if you have a good color printer.
Okay. Mike, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
I appreciate talking to my friends in Canada. I always tell people that the higher the IQ, the more we sell. And and people in Canada seem to have a higher IQ.
Thanks, Mike.
I appreciate it.
Mike St. Lawrence, who offers up alien abduction insurance. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0521, and you'll find links to Mike's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
45-year-old Scott Curtis from Aberdare in Wales was facing charges for possession of drugs after being pulled over by South Wales police. But officers then watched 2 hours of footage from the camera mounted on his Ford Focus that showed him dealing Class A drugs and stopping users in the street. He can even be heard negotiating the price of gear on his mobile phone, gear being a commonly used slang term for drugs. Curtis was jailed for 2.5 years after admitting possession of cocaine and heroin with intent to supply and producing cannabis, said Detective Constable Steve Woolley. Scott tried his best to get away with his crimes. He threw drugs from his vehicle and then claimed that it was all for personal use. But when we played back his own dash cam footage, I don't think he could quite believe it himself. Yeah. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're out on the street selling drugs, would you document your transactions on the dash cam of your own car? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0521. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0521. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple and Google Podcasts, also on Spotify, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.